Matthew does tell us the PGR, Parents Guidance Recommended, version of the Nativity story. But if we imagine ourselves into the story, what was it like for Joseph that night? What was it like for Mary as they scrambled a few things together in the dark dead of night, afraid to light a lamp, no doubt, for fear of attracting attention, hastily retrieving the Magi's valuable and valuably portable gifts from wherever they'd hidden them, sewing them perhaps into the fringes of their garments for safekeeping? What was it like for them when they took the hopefully sleeping child and then stole out of Bethlehem? Desperate, terrified, hiding in the shadows, looking over their shoulders each step of the way, risking everything for the sake of this child. Once they were out of Herod's jurisdiction, did they begin to relax? Or was the fear of the king and his soldiers just replaced by other fears? Wolves? Bandits? Slave traders? Or hunger? Thirst? Exhaustion? Death by wilderness? By natural causes, kind of. And how far did they travel? How long was their journey to Egypt? To which part of Egypt did they go? What route did they take? Did they travel a roundabout way, treading a circuitous path to avoid being hunted down? Or did they lose their way and go in circles by mistake? Well, there are plenty of enthusiasts who love to plot varied routes from Bethlehem to Egypt. These routes may have been taken by Joseph, Mary, and baby Jesus. Maybe, maybe not. In Egypt today, you will find tour guides inviting you to retrace the Holy Family steps. And it's as if Joseph, Mary, and Jesus went on a scenic tour of Egypt and visited every part of that country while they were refugees for however many years that lasted. But the Gospel writer provides no details. We know nothing of the route taken to Egypt, nor of the years that they spent there. All we know is that after the Magi left, an angel appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." We know that Joseph attended to that dream. When he awoke, he acted as instructed and fled that very night. He went to Egypt and he remained there until he had another dream. So the Gospel writer leaves us a gap of several years between the flight to Egypt and the return from Egypt. There's a gap between those two dreams. How long did they stay in Egypt? What was their experience of those years? We aren't told anything, and we don't actually know. But we do have some insight, which comes from the testimonies of other refugees. Across time and across countries, their stories have something of a familiar family type of ring to them. They have similar feelings, similar experiences. The modes of transport vary, the weapons used by those who oppress them vary, technology changes, but the experience of escape and hopefully survival are somewhat the same. It's possible that some of us have histories in our families of escape, of flight, of fear and resettlement. There are some of us who may even have been refugees. But rather than rehearsing some of the fresh and freshly traumatizing stories of people today, nearly 90 million people in our world today displaced by atrocities of various kinds, I want to go back some years to Nicaragua during the Cold War, and then to Afghanistan a little more recently. Ernesto Cardinal and his brother Fernando were priests who ministered among peasant communities, campesinos they called them, in rural Nicaragua during the 1960s, 70s and 80s. Fernando was visiting Ernesto in Salentanami when an army patrol raided the village and church around dawn on Sunday morning. The raid was terrifying, but thank God, no one was hurt and no one was taken that time. The patrol left and the children just exploded, running around, making heaps of noise, completely unable to settle. They had been so frightened. The adults, equally badly shaken but responding to it in a different way, gathered for Mass, they were Catholic, at the usual time. It was around Christmas, and the Gospel reading was from Matthew 2, including our reading from this morning. The congregation listened and received the reading in silence, and then, as was their custom, they began to discuss what they had heard. The first to speak was Fernando, the visiting priest, and he said, "How often have I read that Joseph and the Virgin fled to Egypt? But only now when we are under martial law here in Nicaragua, only now when an army patrol has just raided our village and our church, only now have I really understood the really harsh circumstances into which Jesus was born. Oppression then, oppression now." Ernesto, the regular priest of that church, continued. He said, "Many of our campesino people, our peasant families, have had to leave their homes. They have fled in misery and hunger, or because they have fled because they've been driven off their land by the National Guard, or by landowners who've taken it, or because the National Guard is killing their leaders, burning farmhouses, raping women, torturing whole families. The picture of all those families fleeing, the picture of mothers carrying their babies in their arms, it's the same as we saw in the flight to Egypt. Our experiences here in Nicaragua teach us something about what it was like for Joseph and Mary that night, leaving in the dark, hiding with great fear, leaving everything behind, desperate to reach the border because they too were being pursued." A young man from the congregation then spoke. He pointed out that oppression in Nicaragua took many forms. He said, "Yes, oppression kills some people suddenly, even randomly. It displaces others, forcing them to flee their homes and their lands. But it takes the lives of others, those who are stuck, unwilling or unable to flee. It takes lives through infant mortality, hunger, malnutrition, stunting, disease, lack of education and opportunity." The young man asked, "Which is worse, to flee in fear carrying your child in your arms, or to stay in fear and watch your child fade, fearing for his life and his future? Which is worse?" Let's turn now to a story from Afghanistan, a country that has known decades of trouble. And the story is from a refugee camp in Peshawar, northern Pakistan, back in 2001. Quoting, "We went to bed as normal and woke up between two front lines. We hid, we prayed, we hoped to survive the day, and some of us did. We didn't go out to feed or water the animals. We didn't go outside at all, not even to relieve ourselves. All we wanted was to live. We crouched behind the walls. How many people died that day? We don't know. We didn't count. Bombs, rockets, shrapnel, bullets, it just wouldn't stop. So that night, under cover of darkness, we fled. We took nothing with us, just what little money we had. We didn't have much money. We were villagers, farming people. We traded in grain and animals and yogurt. We wove wool into rugs. You can't run with a rug. And it was just after harvest. Our granaries were full of grain. Our orchards were heavy with fruit. Our cattle, we left them hungry and thirsty in the stalls. Our sheep, don't even mention our sheep. We fled through the darkness, silently, invisibly, too afraid to breathe, let alone talk. God is kind. There was no moon that night. It was dark. But some of our children were lost. We were running for our lives, running through the darkness. We couldn't keep track of them all. We and our older children, we ran with the little ones in our arms or strapped to our backs, but we couldn't carry them all. We ran and we ran and we prayed that some of us would be alive come morning. We brought nothing with us. Once your breath has left your body, what do you want with anything else? Tragically, similar stories have been told by refugees from many parts of rural Afghanistan and for many decades. As the fighting there shifts, different regions and villages are involved. Some families flee before the fighting affects them directly. Others wait, like this family, optimistic until the last moment. Then they run for their lives. To where do they run? Some run deeper into the mountains, where there is little food or sustenance. Others flee to the cities, which are dangerous for rural folk. They live there precariously, tentatively, day to day, depending on goodwill and hospitality. Others flee across borders to seek refuge elsewhere, like those who spoke to me in the refugee camp. Others catch boats and use what we call people smugglers, and they call saviours. When I was in that camp in Peshawar, northern Pakistan, I'd finished talking to people. At that stage, my language was better than it is now. And as I was walking on the edge of the camp on my way out, a woman sang this song. The sky, our only blanket. The rocky ground, our bed. The dust, our only food. The universal lament of refugees and displaced people, a song that could have been sung by Mary on their way from Bethlehem to Egypt. So what were their Egyptian years like for Joseph, Mary and Jesus? How did the Egyptians receive them? Probably not well, because they were different. They didn't worship Egypt's gods, they didn't dress in the right clothes, their manners were atrocious by Egyptian standards, they didn't understand the culture, let alone the language. There was a sizable Jewish community in Egypt. It was a legacy of exiles past, but we don't know whether Joseph sought them out and asked their help. He may well have steered clear of his own people. He would have expected Herod and the ruling priests to have spies everywhere. So how did the family survive? Thanks to the Magi, they had some resources to draw on while travelling and until Joseph found work. Would he find work? His reputation as a skilled artisan meant nothing there in Egypt. And work, when he could get it, was probably hard labour, unskilled labour, arduous, possibly dangerous, and always poorly paid, because this was a slave state, and where there are slaves, why pay someone for work if their work will cost more than your slaves? What about Jesus? As he grew up, what did he remember of that nighttime escape from Bethlehem? Did he remember anything of the fear in his parents' voices, as they warned him not to cry, not to laugh, not to make any sound at all? Did he remember anything of that journey? Did he remember his parents' weariness and his own hunger and thirst? Did he remember arriving in Egypt, his parents knowing no one, unable to speak the language, desperate to find lodging and some work, not knowing where to start? Did he experience loneliness and fear being on the outside, not belonging? Did he remember his parents receiving news from Bethlehem? Did they hold him tight while they wept for the children that had died, whose parents had not been warned to flee in the night? What did he remember? What did his parents tell him? What did he discover later after returning to the land of Israel? Jesus, God with us, was not born into a safe, secure, calm environment. He did not enjoy good nutrition as a child. He did not go to a good school. He did not get off to a good start. God so loved the world that he gave his only son. God so loved the world that he risked everything, even his son. God so loved the world that Jesus came even compelled to flee a refugee child. It is scandalous, isn't it, that the creator of heaven and earth would be born into such a vulnerable, dangerous situation, threatened by a tyrannical king, his human parents fleeing with him to a foreign land. It's scandalous that 2,000 years ago, the Son of God was a refugee in Egypt. And it's scandalous that today, or at the end of 2021, there are an estimated 89 million people forcibly displaced by persecution, conflict, violence, human rights abuses, in other words, by human evil. Around one quarter of these, 21 million, are refugees hosted by other countries. And it's scandalous that in 2018, 17 million people were displaced by climate-related events. That was 2018, before the seemingly endless series of extreme weather events that we've witnessed more recently. These climate-related events were once called natural disasters. Now we know that they have something to do with us. They were not as natural as they were once thought. And it's scandalous that, with the exception of Germany, the wealthy nations of the world generally leave the poorer nations to provide shelter for all of these displaced people. It's scandalous that wealthy nations like Australia are more intent on keeping people out, on turning them away and on locking them up, than they are on giving a safe place to stay, a home. Jesus and his family were refugees. Do our leaders remember that when devising and implementing border and immigration policies? Do we remember that when praying about our individual, our congregational, and our national response to those seeking refuge, those who cannot stay in their own homes? Shortly before he died, the adult Jesus told his stories, a disciple, about a time when the Son of Man would return in all his glory and the nations would be judged. During that story, he said, "Truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did it for me. Truly I tell you, whatever you did not do for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did not do it for me." As Abraham once welcomed angels unawares, we might think about whom we are welcoming or not welcoming unawares this Christmas. For we welcome the Christ child in the least of these. And in that welcome, how do we do it practically? Four simple suggestions. First, we've already talked about Baptist World Aid and its work enabling life in places that are quite desperate at times through poverty or persecution. And this is a way to help people not be displaced. We need to welcome those who are displaced, but before that we need to make life, or do what we can to make life more tenable in people's own homes so they are not forced to flee. Second, we have the Welcome Home Project that we've talked about. And in your newsletter, you'll see that there's going to be an information session in February where we can see how we, some of our members of the church, might join a group to help welcome refugees come into Australia. I'd encourage those of us who can to go to that information session. It doesn't mean you're committing yourself to anything, but you might find out that you want to be involved, or you might find out that you want to stand behind and be with another person of our church who will be involved. Third, I think we need to think about walking lightly, about reducing our impact on the planet with all these conflicts and all of these climactic disasters happening. That does have something to do with how we live. As part of trying to reduce the causes of displacement, we need to think about, well, what do we need to change in order that other people can stay where they are and the world not be so badly damaged? And finally, if we go back to that story in the dreams that Joseph had, the angel of the Lord appearing to him at night, then maybe we need to think about how we're attending to God. Are we listening? Are we paying attention? Do we discern which dreams are of God and which are not? Are we prepared to act on what God might be telling us to do? Even in the Nativity, there are shadows of what is going to come. Jesus didn't just enter danger in his final years before he died and rose again. He was in danger from the moment he was conceived. We need to remember that God does not promise us a life of security and comfort. He promises us a life of service and contribution, and that sometimes takes us too into dangerous and uncomfortable places where we might not necessarily feel at home. I will read a prayer come poem by Mike Hollows as a benediction today, which keeps our focus on the love and promise and resurrection of God in a damaged and suffering world. I will dance upon your rusted, busted tanks with every child who plays where death played out its final game, their joy with mine entwined in hope of peace. And I will weep for every broken childhood, every orphaned heart, every pillaged innocence plundered by your violence and greed. And I will shout that I have been a child conceived in obscurity, born in a corner of someone else's empire, a victim born to die. And I will smile as tender shoots push through the scattered vestiges of war, for I can see the hope long hidden from the poor, and I will shine, and darkness will not comprehend, and I will be their glory, their hope until the end. Love born in Bethlehem, love raised in glory, Jesus Christ, the hope of the world. Amen.